I'm here, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to week two of my Batman month here on the Deepest Lore. And I'm very pleased today to be able to introduce Chuck Dixon, an absolutely legendary comic book writer. I don't know if this is true, but I read that you are the Guinness Book of World Records holder.
It's not official, but the stats are there. I mean, I beat Paul S. Newman, my closest competitor.
Yeah, do you know, just before we get started, I discovered that the Guinness Book of World Records was actually started by the managing director of Guinness. And until that moment, I'd never drawn the two together.
It was a promotional gimmick, right? I mean,
yeah, apparently they were trying to settle a bet in a pub or something, but yeah, anyway, Chuck Dixon has written over 40,000 pages of comics, including phenomenal run on Detective Comics, one of the main Batman books through the 90s, as well as Robin, Nightwing. What else have you done? Conan, The Punisher,
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Simpsons. I mean, the list goes on and on, right?
Yes.
So I'll start by asking you, even though I'm a longtime reader of comics, I don't really understand what a writer actually does. I mean, I understand you write the story and that you write the script in the speech bubbles,
right?
But how does it all work? Do you write the script and then hand it over to the artist? Do you sit down with the artist beforehand so they've both got an idea of what's going on? Can you explain how the process works
for everybody watching? Usually, unless it's with like a frequent collaborator, it just begins with me and I write the script, which looks very much like a screenplay. There's two ways to write comics. There's one to give the artist the plot and dialogue it later, which I hate. Because I think it leads to confusion. And then there's the way that I do it and the way most comic writers do it, which is full script. And like I said, it looks very much like a screenplay. Everything's there. It's broken down panel by panel. All the dialogue, sound effects, everything are included. And then that's when the collaboration begins. If the artist suggests changes or, you know, whatever, modifications, you take it from there.
So in that script, do you say, I don't know, close up of Batman's face, or do you leave that up to the artist?
It's kind of like a director's script. I will suggest angles. I will make sure they know that this panel is an establishment panel. So give us a good shot of Wayne Manor so we know visually where we are. I will say this is a page turn panel or this is a segue panel, that kind of thing. So it's very much like a director's script, but I don't hold the artist to any of my directions. If they have a better idea, they're artists. Why wouldn't I listen to them?
So do you have any artists you prefer to work with and why?
I'll hurt like hundreds of people's feelings by making a list, but obviously I've frequently collaborated with Gary Kwapis, with Graham Nolan, Sergio Cariello, and we've become close friends over the years.
And was there ever a time you were unhappy with what an artist had done? Don't have to name names if you don't want to.
Well, generally, I mean, I was so prolific, particularly at DC in the 90s, that they would use me to break new guys in. And I knew what, you know, I knew what I was in for. You know, this guy isn't quite ready for prime time, but they're giving him one of my scripts. And, you know, okay, maybe I was a little disappointed, but then a lot of those guys went on to become superstars. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I found, because hello, can you hear me? Sorry, Chuck. Have I lost him? Hello. Okay, I think he's frozen himself. Let's see if he comes back. I have so much stuff to ask this guy. Let's have a look. He's been frozen by Mr. Freeze. See if he comes back. I'll email him. Okay. All right, so I'm back, but he's gone. Okay, let's see. Let's see what happens. Yeah, well, next week on Batman Month, I'm going to be looking at more comics. I was actually thinking about doing some sort of primer to help people follow along, but at the moment, I'm seeing if Chuck Dixon will come back. Let's have a look. Maybe his internet froze. Oh, dear. I was about to ask him a great question as well. I need to remember what I was going to ask him now. I actually asked him if he'd seen the new movie before he came, and he hasn't watched it. I noticed I was reading over one of his Riddler stories earlier on, and there's actually a moment that they stole directly from it where hello, Chuck, you're back. Sorry.
It's Florida. I think a seagull landed on a phone line somewhere.
People were saying Mr. Freeze got you, Mr. Freeze. I was just about to say I've been reading over a lot of the big crossover arcs in the 90s, and one of my kind of bugbears of that period is that I don't know if it was because of like the popularity of Arkham Asylum, which I mean, personally, I find a bit overrated, to be honest. But there was this kind of scratchy art style that people liked to use around that time. Mm. I mean, not Graham Nolan. He was a kind of classic, bat artist, you know, right, in my mind. But what was that like? What was that trend going on in the 90s? Like, and did that ever bother you?
Yeah, it bothered me a lot, particularly on covers. Apparently the editors were in love with that kind of style, or they felt this was a new trend. It was a desperate time in the 90s where they were all trying to catch up with the success of Image and trying to figure out, what is it the fans want? And they landed on this kind of, you know, it's just an ugly art style. And I thought it hurt sales because the, you know, covers didn't look attractive. And it took some time for Graham and I to convince them to allow us, you know, to allow Graham to do the covers. Mm-hmm. And he did classic covers. I mean, they're gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think if you read back, I mean, it doesn't matter what the arc is, like Contagion or Cataclysm or whatever, that those issues or those little mini stories that they have in that scratchy style, it really breaks things up as well. So yeah. Now, while we're on the subject of artists, what does an inker do? I noticed on a lot of your, especially in the first half of your run with Graham Nolan, it was inked by Scott Hanna.
Yes.
How much of a difference can the inker make?
Well, they can, you know, they can either help the artist or hurt the artist, the pencil artist. I consider the inkers like the Jedi masters of comics because no one quite understands what it is they do. And what they do is they add dimension and weight to the art. You know, they don't just make it clearer. They make it, you know, they really do embellish it. And a good inker, just like a good letterer, can help a story immensely. And a bad inker and a bad letterer can ruin it.
DC DC had a habit during this period of bringing back Bronze Age legends like Jim Aparo, for example, for random issues. What was it like as the writer when someone as respected and senior as Aparo was brought in to do the artwork and did the dynamic change?
Well, I mean, I knew I was in good hands. I mean, the guy was terrific at storytelling, understood the characters. You didn't have to explain anything to him, certainly. He was there longer than me. Plus, you know, Jim is just an awesome guy. Just a real sweetheart of a guy.
You had a legendary run on Detective Comics right through the 1990s. Now, for most of that time, there was Doug Mensch on Batman. Mm-hmm. Alan Grant was on Shadow of the Bat. First of all, what did it mean to you to work on DC's flagship character in his original book? And can you explain in your eyes the difference between Detective Comics and Batman, like the two different books?
Well, I mean, I was thrilled to be offered, of all the books, to be offered Detective, to me was the biggest honor because it's the longest running American comic book. And, you know, the comic that created Batman. So it was one of the rare times where I was asked, do you want to take this book on? And I immediately said yes. I didn't need any time to think about it. The differences between the books, editorial didn't say these books all have to be different. Each one of us, Doug and Alan and myself, took it upon ourselves to create the tone of each book. And to me, detective means mysteries. Detective means actual crime stories. So I always lean toward that. Doug leaned toward, you know, classic theme villains and sort of creepy situations for Batman. And then Alan, being Alan, just went off on his own, created all these new villains. And, you know, he was freed of any encumbrances to do the Batman stories that he always wanted to do.
Yeah. How come Grant was given his own book during that period? Like, why did Shadow of the Bat exist? I know you wrote a few later on.
Basically, it was to make sure all three of us had work. Denny wanted, he wanted Nightfall created by myself, Doug, and Alan. And of course, we had to give Alan a regular monthly part in the process. And Batman sales were strong enough. And Alan's work was incredible up to that point. I mean, he was keeping that franchise alive. So Denny wanted to give him his own. Now, I don't know if he discussed with Alan, did he want to take over Batman? Or if Alan said, no, I'd like to create a new book. I don't know. You know, that may have been discussed prior. But when we went into that first Nightfall meeting, it was decided that these would be the three books. It was a book created so Alan would be a major part of Nightfall.
Did you get on well with the both of them? Because, I mean, I think you three were on, you were the team for a long time, you know, like
a decade. We were writers, and writers are a suspicious lot. But we got along well in the work. There was never any problems. I mean, we worked seamlessly, and we all had a job to do, and we all got our major parts. You know, when you have an ensemble cast and everybody gets their moment, we got lots of moments. So it wasn't like anybody was being short shrifted. And Denny was so fair about everything. I mean, when it came to the Spawn Batman crossover, which we all knew was going to pay enormous royalties, Denny said, I can't give it to just one of you. It's too big a bone to throw to one person. So I'm going to split it amongst the three of you, and then you'll all make money. I've never run into a situation like that in comics where the editor understood, you know, you have to be fair to everybody in the team.
Now, for most of this run, you also wrote Robin and Nightwing.
Yeah.
How did you manage to write all the material concurrently? Because the quantity of the output is staggering.
Well, I've always stayed way ahead of deadline. That's how I work. That's how I keep up, by staying way ahead. If I get an assignment, I'm on it. To give you an example, I mean, I didn't work this way any other time, but on Nightwing, I had enough of a lead time that I wrote the first 12 issues before Scott McDaniel ever started penciling. And that allowed me not only to be a year ahead, but it gave me the time to go back over it and make sure it all flowed, you know, as one big year-long story. And so generally, I stayed so far ahead of schedule at DC that they stopped sending me. They would send you these schedules by mail every month. They just stopped sending them because I'd always blown past them. So that gave me room. If something new came up, I could say, yeah, I got time in my schedule.
But presumably later on when they started, like, because, I mean, I think it's fair to say DC went a bit crossover mad after Nightfall. Like, presumably you couldn't do, you know, when you're into Cataclysm and so on, you couldn't just say, all right, well, here's like the next 2 years of Nightwing.
No. In fact, Contagion particularly, because I believe it was that the way the issues came out, Doug wrote Batman, and then I had Robin and I believe Nightwing and Detective before Alan's next book would be released. And so there were, like, in the middle of Contagion, there were two times that month that I had to write an issue a day to stay ahead of Alan.
Wow.
And both times I had little kids at home. I checked into a motel room and wrote there.
I can relate to that trick. I'm actually sitting in a lodge because I have a little 2-year-old, and I ended up just buying a lodge because I literally cannot work with her. Now I have to ask, as the person who probably wrote both Dick Grayson and Tim Drake the best, do you have a favorite out of the two of them, and why?
Yeah, that's really hard to choose. I really can't, because I mean, I grew up with Dick Grayson. Obviously, he was Robin, but Tim Drake, because I had a large part in establishing him as a character. It's a lot of affection there. So yeah, it's hard to choose between the two.
I have to say, like, every once in a blue moon, Dick drops into Gotham, and they have one of these like heart to hearts. And for some reason, I always find them like really heartbreaking, those little moments, because it's like Dick is the only character who's willing to call Bruce out on his bullshit, if that makes any sense. So there's a, I don't know, I find those moments really, really touching. So as we said, this is the era of the massive crossover arcs. And you worked on pretty much all of them: Nightfall, Contagion, Legacy, which I really like, Cataclysm, The Road to No Man's Land, as it's called now, kind of massive omnibus that they brought out, and No Man's Land itself. How did all of that work? I know Denny O'Neill, who's a truly legendary figure, was the editor. Mm-hmm. He was writing Asriel for most of that period. Did he give all of the other writers direction? How much coordination was there between you and the other writers, and how much creative freedom was there?
Well, on Nightfall, you know, we held like three different summits, because Nightfall was 2 years of continuity, and it was mostly all completely laid out by Denny, not issue by issue, but the story and how it would break down. And what we would do at the summits was we would break it down. We would decide, okay, what's going to happen in each issue. This required, I think at one point, like 10 whiteboards with assistant editors making, you know, diagrams and schedules as we talked. And then all of that was typed up and given to us so that we knew each issue, where it had to begin, where it had to end, and, you know, somewhat of what had to happen in the issue. Surprisingly, a lot of the rest of the issue was left up to us, so we could, you know, actually have an individual story arc within the larger arc. But and everybody stayed on schedule. I mean, everybody was dogged about that, so there were never any problems or hiccups. I mean, it just worked like a machine. It was all run by Denny. The crossovers that followed were not quite as tightly organized as Nightfall. But we were already in motion then. We already worked together like a machine. So it all went well.
And when you say Nightfall, is that like the entire saga or just the part that we tend to talk? Like, did you have the idea of, I don't know, that there was going to be Asriel as Batman for so many issues and what happens in those issues and so on? Or
Yeah. Except we had to cut that short because readers hated Asriel so much that sales began to drop. And so we had to cut his portion of the saga short and bring back Bruce.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, when I've been reading through every once in a while, it's like, oh God, isn't that Azrael issue? But to be honest, they're not that bad. I can see why. Most famously, you created Bane, also a lot of other things. I read somewhere, for example, that you were the person who came up with the Iceberg Lounge, which changed the Penguin forever. Yeah. Actually, yeah. It appeared in the recent movie.
I heard that. Yeah.
What original creation in the Batman lore are you proudest of, and why?
That I'm proudest of?
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say Bane, because he's become a household name. I mean, you know, literally, you know, like everybody that can get to a movie theater or a TV knows who he is. I mean, they make jokes about him. You know, stand-up comics make jokes about him. So, you know, he's always going to be my crowning achievement.
Yeah. Did you actually go and watch I know you said you didn't watch the recent movie, but did you watch the Dark Knight Returns and the Joel Schumacher film?
I've seen portions of the Joel Schumacher film. I have seen Dark Knight Rises, I think twice. But yeah, I've seen them.
What did you think of what they did in each of them?
Looked great. He looked great in the Schumacher film, but it was, you know, he was a moron. I didn't like that. I like that in the Nolan film, he's a mastermind, but he's not the ultimate mastermind, which was a bit disappointing. But he is imposing and scary, and but you know, I still want to see, you know, the Bane that Graham and I created on the big screen someday. I think that'll happen. I mean, I hear talk of a Bane solo film, much like the Joker film. So,
mm-hmm. We'll see. I mean, he's a lot, how can I say, like even the Nolan version, he's still not the kind of, you know, this is a character who can play chess with Ra's al Ghul and beat him, you know? So, right. And that side of him, I still don't think we've seen him to his full, you know, as you guys wrote him. Yeah. Just on the subject of the Schumacher film, I mean, I don't know. I hear that Denny O'Neill hated the Adam West 60s Batman, and he dedicated his life to basically, like, his life's work was trying to rescue Batman from Adam West Batman as he saw it.
Right.
Do you remember when that film came out? Like, how much stuff was undone by those Schumacher movies?
Oh, well, in general, even the Tim Burton movies didn't help us. Our sales went down when Batman Returns was released because so many parents were horrified. They took their kids to see a Batman movie, and then there's all this really adult material and frightening material in it. And I saw it myself when I went to see it at a matinee, and kids, parents were taking their, you know, screaming, crying kids out of the theater, you know, with that first Penguin scene, and our sales actually went down. So the movies never really helped us at all.
That's interesting.
You know, as Batman became more and more a key figure in pop culture, the comics were sliding into irrelevancy. It's a strange process.
Now, alongside all of this, in the 90s, there was also the Batman, the animated series, which I think a lot of people have fond memories of. And I think the main writer on there was Paul Dini.
Right.
Now, he seemed to take a lot of things from the comics, like, for example, the Iceberg Lounge. He then brought the Iceberg Lounge into the animated series.
Right.
How often did it go the other way? Like, did you guys ever take things from the animated series?
I took the villain Lockup, and I took Condiment King. I used Condiment King a lot. I thought it was a brilliant idea. It was such a historically funny idea. And there was a lot of cross-pollination then, because Paul Dini and Bruce Timm would visit the DC offices quite frequently. And, you know, we would run into them, go to lunch with them and everything else. So there was a lot of back and forth there. And I think it helped us, because they brought a different approach, and it certainly helped them, because they loved mining previous material.
Yeah. Now on this, on Dini, I think I was saying before we came on air, I don't quite agree. Like, obviously, I respect him as a legend and so on, but I don't quite agree with O'Neill that Batman has to be this kind of grim, you know, dark, you know, it's the Frank Miller, you know, the bastard Batman. Right. I've always thought there is this more colorful side to it, you know, with the colorful rogues gallery, and I felt that Dini got that. Mike W. Barr got it, although his issues of Detective are bonkers. But I mean, they've got gorgeous art with Alan Davis. But I also thought that you got this, that there was this. You have to kind of balance the, you know, the grim, gritty Gotham with the fun. You know, the kind of seeing the villains and giving that, like, the, I guess what you call it, the capers. Was this, like, how did you navigate that when O'Neill was the, like, how strictly did he insist on Batman being this dark, gritty thing?
Well, I mean, he was very much a hands-off editor. He trusted the instincts of the people he hired, and he hired them for that reason, because he thought he could trust them. He knew we all loved the character, and we were as dedicated to it as he was. And I certainly understand what he did, what his mission was to basically take Batman back to his earlier roots, so that Batman wasn't always thought of as this campy figure, you know, this figure of parody. And he obviously accomplished that, you know, beyond even his wildest dreams. But I liked the 66 show, not as a kid, I hated it, but as an adult, I liked it. And I would incorporate elements from it, but I had to hide them because Denny wanted no part of the 66 show. So there's a lot of hidden references to the show inside of my stories. But I like that idea of, you know, I mean, the concept of superheroes is goofy at its heart. So you kind of sometimes have to lean into it. Mm-hmm. You know, the more realistic you make superheroes, the less entertaining they are, in my opinion. So I would put humor in, and Batman wasn't, you know, he wasn't Willie Loman all the time. He wasn't just sad and depressed and thinking about his parents constantly.
Yeah, now I've got this little section, Chuck, which I've called the geek box, where I'm really going to, like, you know, I've got this opportunity to ask you a couple of questions. I will say that not everybody in the audience is like a super duper comic fan. So forgive me, there's going to be some esoteric stuff in here, okay? Because speaking of these Silver Age references, there's one issue in Detective Comics 725 where it starts where Batman or Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson are reminiscing. And we get this flashback to a Silver Age adventure, to the giant bowling pins that you see in the Batcave. And there's this villain called the Bowler that we see. And I was like, the Bowler, I've never heard of him. And I went down on, I spent like, you know, a whole hour. I was like, who is this Bowler? I need to find, you know. I went back and I found that he didn't exist. Like, he's referenced in the original comic, like back in the Silver Age, but you never see him.
Right.
So what was the idea of giving an appearance to the Bowler?
It's just, you know, I wanted, you know, the goofy big props that Bill Finger and Dick Sprang used to use. And I didn't want to go back to an actual Silver Age adventure. Maybe I just didn't feel like looking one up at the time. So I just invented one. And I thought, well, bowling pins, that's kind of cool.
Did you know he was actually referenced, the Bowler, though? There is an actual reference to this Bowler, but you never see him.
Wow.
In Detective Comics 711, there's a brilliant Graham Nolan front cover. It's got Batman with all his rogues gallery on the back computer. And yet you open the issue and it features only Bruce Wayne and no villains whatsoever. Was that an intentional fake out?
I think Graham just wanted to put an iconic cover on it. You know, you didn't want to have a Bruce Wayne cover. And then that issue had to be a standalone story. And I had played for a long time about having just the Bruce Wayne story in which he has to basically be Batman without ever putting the costume on. And the other proviso for that story was editorial said it had to begin in the convenience store because it was issue 711.
Yeah, in fact, it was weird, like, because it reminded me like falling down or something. You know,
yeah.
Now another thing that you love to do is to rehabilitate minor characters or just create them. Like there's the Clue Master Arthur Brown, who is just this like D-list villain that comes back a lot. Firefly, who you did a makeover for. Query and Echo, like the Riddler's hench girls. William Petit, who becomes like a major character in No Man's Land, this kind of like lieutenant, I guess, that Gordon has got, who he argues with. There's the Actuary, Jay Devlin Davenport. I mean, there's loads of these kind of ancillary characters in the background, and you make really extensive use of these. So first of all, like, is there a method or is there a reason why you love these, bringing these minor characters in, and do you have a favorite of them?
I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I loved characters like, you know, the Willie the Mailman in Fantastic Four. You know, it gave a continuity to things. Like, it's not just a generic guy or woman. It's someone we've seen before. And even if they never play a major part in a story, it's kind of makes the world seem more believable if you bring these characters, background characters, to life. Because, I mean, in the Silver Age, they would just introduce a character as a plot device they needed and then just completely forget about them. But I'm like, well, Bruce has to have neighbors. So I create this neighbor and then give him a consistent role in the stories. I think he's my favorite, Jay Devlin Davenport, because he's such an a-hole. And I liked him because he showed up the contrast between Bruce Wayne and Batman, the masquerade that Batman has to play when he's Bruce Wayne, of being sort of an affable, distracted, sometimes doofus, but he's not, he never is. But so that he allows Devlin to win all their golf games and tennis games and things like that, because that's part of the play. And the fun for the reader is that, you know, Batman could destroy this guy at any one of these games, but chooses not to. And the thing is that I was building Davenport toward something. And we did an arc, Graham and I did an arc featuring Captain Fear, a pirate-themed Batman villain. And we were going to play it out over like 6 months' time, and then you would find out that Captain Fear was Jay Devlin Davenport. And but the editors hated that storyline so much that they wouldn't allow us to continue it.
Why did they hate it?
They hated Captain Fear. And the weird thing is Graham and I created the Captain Fear arc, and we intentionally wanted to do our classic take on Batman. It has everything a classic Batman story has, including a trap. And traps aren't easy to write. But we had devised a trap. We had devised a new theme villain, new henchmen, all these new situations. And it all wraps up in three neatly done issues. And we were so proud of it. And then the editors literally sat me down to tell me how much they hated that story.
I mean, this is going to be my last little geek box question. But the idea of pirate villain has reminded me of Captain Stingery. And I went back and had a look at some of the Bronze Age kind of anniversary issues and things. There's one that there's actually one called Resurrection Night, which is the, I think, meant to be the very last appearance of that version of Batman, where all of the villains are sprung out. But there's a previous one, I think, at the end of Jerry Conway's run, he does a net, like one of these stories where all the villains break out of Arkham, and there's a load of characters there who just disappear. Like Captain Stingery is one of them, right? The Spook, right? It seems like the Spook was almost like a kind of second tier, or even like getting on to being A-tier villain in the 70s, and then he's just gone.
Right.
Is there any reason why you guys didn't use any of those, like these sorts of, they just disappear completely after it, about 1986?
A simple answer for me was I don't think I was reading a lot of the comics then, so I just wasn't as familiar. I mean, when I was bringing characters back, it was ones I remembered from when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And wanted to bring back or rehabilitate or change in some way, or had a problem with. I always had a problem with Clue Master, so I brought him back to torture him.
Yeah, I mean the other thing I quite like is that there's a real sense of hierarchy between, say, for like there's one issue I remember. The Joker is just so disappointed to be facing like Azrael. He's like, "What, you're sending like second stringers? I'm insulted," you know. Yeah. Or like I don't know. There's one issue I read where I think Mr. Freeze busts in and the Rat Catcher is there, and Mr. Freeze is like, "Who the fuck are you?" type thing. So there's a real there's a real kind of sense of like who's an A-lister, who's a B-lister, who's a C-lister. I kind of dig that, you know.
Yeah, I just like the idea that they don't all know each other, you know. And I love having characters meet who were you never saw meet before. I love writing scenes like that.
I mean, I think the exact line that you give, Mr. Freeze keeps on calling him Rat Man. And he's like, "It's the Rat Catcher," and he's like, "Well, yeah, whatever, just shut up." So coming back now, I find that Batman has a lot of reactionary themes. Gotham is totally corrupt. There's one issue where you have Bruce Wayne go to Washington in the middle of the Road to No Man's Land stuff. We see that Congress is not much better. You literally call it a nest of vipers. I think in Batman, you see the tragic vision of man. To what extent do you agree with that? And how much were you thinking about these things at the time?
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't even think I have to think about them. It's just you intuit it. This is a guy who knows what the world's about. He has no illusions. You know, even though he runs around in a costume dressed as a giant bat, he has no illusions. So that scene where he goes to Washington, I mean, that was like editorially dictated, but not what he was going to say. He testifies, you know, go for it. And I just was inspired by, you know, Howard Hughes's testimony before the Senate in the 1950s, when they accused him of basically feathering his nest with defense projects. And he just went after them. So they left him alone. It's much like the scene in Iron Man 2. They were obviously inspired by that as well.
Now, how did the... Because obviously, you know, you're on the, you know, on the right side of things, the correct side of things, if you want. but I mean, I get the impression that Denny O'Neill was a liberal, right?
Oh yeah.
Alan Grant.
I don't know what Alan is. I spent hours talking politics with Alan, and he is a free thinker.
Yeah, I mean, there's one issue. I think it's in the legacy. In the legacy run, where there's this old man in Scotland, and he's like depressed and alone, and it's raining, and like the issue wraps up where they bring he kind of rediscovers his spirit as a Pict or something, and I'm like, whoa, these are like, you know. They're kind of reactionary themes, you know. He has to find transcendence. I was like, wow, maybe Alan Grant isn't. You'd expect him to be liberal with all the psychology, right? But
yeah, he's if you gave me a list of issues, I couldn't tell you where Alan fell on any of them. He's not. There's no boxing him in. Fascinating guy, absolutely fascinating guy.
So, given that we have this relentlessly grim situation, why doesn't Batman give up? Because I have to admit, there's been times I find myself agreeing with Ra's al Ghul. Like, why not just burn it all down, you know?
I just think that, you know, I mean, the question for me is, I mean, he does it initially because his parents were killed and he feels like he owes it to them. But why does he keep doing it? You know, and I just think he thinks that it would all as bad as it is, it would all be worse without me. And he couldn't live with that guilt.
I mean, yeah, but there's a few panels in No Man's Land though where it's like, literally, the population of Gotham was halved. They've had two plagues, an earthquake, the highest crime rate in America, and it's literally decommissioned by the U.S. government. I mean, his record is an absolute fail. like in objective terms, he's failed, right? But he still carries on going, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing is that, you know, Cataclysm and Contagion, they were sort of out of his hands. Yeah. You know, there was nothing he could do about it. I mean, these are Superman-level threats, and he wasn't equipped. Mm-hmm. But he keeps soldiering on because, you know, he's Batman, and he's the only one that can do that.
There are some jaw-dropping moments in No Man's Land. There's one where there's one – I can't remember who wrote the issue, but there's one where – he turns up and the people just like fall at his feet. And he's like, look, I want to give you your freedom. And he's like, no, we want direction. And then he's like, okay, then these are the new, I'll be your feudal lord. I'm like, holy shit. you know, and then Superman turns up. Superman does turn up and he's like, he can't get with a new status quo. And then Batman tells him to bugger off back to Metropolis. It's kind of amazing. Now, as a side note, I mentioned Ra's al Ghul there. I love the Bane and the Demon story. It's now collected in Batman Legacy Volume 2. I think it was originally a standalone. Interplay between Bane and Ra's and Talia is really cool. Which villains did you like writing most in general?
I don't know. I mean, there's all different kinds of villains. You mean which of the two of them?
No. Were there any villains that you liked writing? And by the same token, I guess, were there any villains that you didn't like writing? You know.
Well, I liked Bane, obviously, because, you know, I got to tell a story, this epic story of his life. My favorite was the Riddler. But the problem with the Riddler is Riddler stories aren't easy to write, which is why I didn't write him more often. To do a good Riddler story, you've really got to sweat riddles. Everything has to make sense. Joker is easy to write because, you know, he has to be funny. Because I insist the Joker's jokes have to be funny. They can't just be jokes. They can't be dad jokes. They actually have to make you laugh. But that's not as hard as coming up with a series of riddles that all both lead to the crime and lead away from it simultaneously. Riddler is probably my favorite. Catwoman also, because Catwoman is one of the few comic book characters who likes herself, and it's refreshing to write a character like that.
I have to tell people this because I've just read it just this morning. Because I'd read a lot of your stuff, but I hadn't gone back and had a look at some of the in between issues. There's a three part Riddler arc that you write. In fact, where the Query and the Echo are there, they kidnap Clue Master and torture him. I was saying that there's a bit that in the Batman movie they actually take that idea where he's got the bomb strapped to him and they have to do the riddles in the 15 minutes. But that plot is so complex, it's just insane. You've got Oracle like tracing. That is really complex, that plot.
Took 2 years to write. It took me 2 years before I was ready to go to script on that one.
Wow.
Yeah. I had to read an entire book on baseball scoring. I'm not even a baseball fan, but I thought I gotta have a theme for these riddles. And I thought, well, baseball is kind of, it's visual, it's fun. And then I read an article about baseball scoring, which is literally you sit and watch the game and write symbols in these little box score things. Mm-hmm. And that there are people who have these scorecards that they've collected over decades, and they can go back and look at that card and relive that game moment by moment. I thought, well, that's so weird. That'd be something the Riddler would be fascinated by. And then built the story around that. I mean, Graham thought I was nuts. I said, the riddles are based on baseball scoring. And he says, "You mean baseball?" I said, "No, the actual scoring of the game."
Yeah, I mean that. I have to say, of all the Riddler plots I've read, that one is pretty. I mean, it's so complex.
And the thing is, when you do these things, you go, well, I mean, I had so many riddle books, but you end up having to write half the riddles yourself. And that's the hardest part.
Yeah. I reviewed the new Batman movie last week. And I think the trouble with the Riddler is that you do run the risk of the Adam West, it's in the sea, you know, C for Catwoman. Holy smokes, you know. It does take like really skilled writing, I think, to get out of that kind of
the best Riddler story on film is Die Hard 3. Jeremy Irons is the Riddler. And it's a perfect Riddler story because it leads the police and the heroes away from the crime at the same time leaving clues as to what the crime was and where they are.
Are there any hidden gem stories from your DC run that you'd encourage people to seek out?
I got a soft spot for Captain Leatherwing. It's Detective Annual 7. Mm-hmm. Am I dead again?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah.
Oh, you can hear me. All my screens went blank. Okay. Yeah, I saw a spot for Detective Annual 7. It's an Elseworlds story where Batman is a pirate. And beautifully drawn by Kike Akatina.
Now I've heard on the grapevine that you do some work for Vox Day, many of people in our circles would have heard of. How did that come about?
He contacted me. I think I wrote something or something, and he realized that maybe we might be, if not kindred spirits, at least have common ground. I don't agree with everything Vox says. He doesn't agree with everything I believe, but he allows me creative freedom and a venue through ArcTunes and things like that. And he's very encouraging. I just finished a project for him I'm really excited about. I can't wait till we announce it. And I think it's going to be it's going to be big. And I'm not given the hyperbole, but I think this one's going to be big.
Yeah. Now, where can people find that stuff?
If you go to arkhaven.com or just Google Arkhaven Comics and you look for ArcTunes, it's a free digital comic service. And it's got, dozens and dozens of weekly series. It's in high res. I mean, you can read it on the big screen in your living room and it's crystal clear. And I do a number of series there, All Hero Q, My Sister Suprema, Something Big, and a whole bunch of others.
Great. And is there anything else that you're working on at the moment that you'd like people to check out?
Like I said, nothing I can talk about yet. But I do write novels. If you go on Amazon, put my name in. I just completed, I think, my 31st novel. So I'm a comic writer. I'm not a novelist, but I reached a point where there wasn't enough comic work, and then I got into the habit of writing novels.
Great. Now, if it's all right with you, Chuck, people send in super chats and questions. Are you sure. Right to...
Please do.
Yuz the Eunuch says, riddle me this, riddle me that. AA started the stream on time, so I leave my... Yeah, I'm usually late, but I was...
And then I went dead on you.
Yuz the Eunuch says, Batman isn't supposed to be the Punisher. DC made him the Punisher via desperation and making movie money. I'd like to hear Chuck's ideas on this as well as AA's. I think classic Batman is superior. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, very specific ones. Going into Nightfall, I remember bringing up the idea that if we replace Bruce Wayne with basically a homicidal psychotic as Batman, I said, we run the risk that some readers may prefer him to Bruce Wayne. And I said, we have to make this character so odious that we once and for all put down the idea that a lethal Batman would be preferable. And we did our job too well, as I said, because our sales went down. Everybody hated John Paul Valley, but we made our point. And I think, I think the point stands.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is no question that Batman is not, I mean, I don't think he's the Punisher. If you read through it, I will say that he's extremely bossy towards when he's got the whole Bat family around. I mean, it's like, holy shit. I'm not sure if you want him as a boss, because he doesn't like, there's a few issues that, uh, I, I, I think he wrote them when he's just giving like an absolute bollocking to the Huntress. You know, you fail three times, get out type thing, you're fired. Maybe that happens in No Man's Land, I think. But
I had him give Huntress a hard time a few, because he didn't want her. As he tried to control her, he knew he couldn't get rid of her, but he didn't want her out on the street. But he didn't know what to do about it. So he like Frank Castle, he can be a manipulative prick. He is a user.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have a look at some other super chats here. Drongo says, PSA, subscribe and unsubscribe sporadically to remove vile numerology from AA subscriber account. Mobilize the trucks. I currently got 66.6 thousand subscribers. So
wow.
People aren't happy because it's 666. Herlock Shome says, I think you called him Truck Dixon last week.
I own a truck.
Bristol Berserker says, did you prefer writing Batman or Punisher? And who do you feel would be more effective as a vigilante and at stopping crime in real life?
Well, I have an affinity for the Punisher. I don't know why. He's the easiest character for me to write. And I still think of stories for him, even though I'm not paid to. And obviously he would be the more effective crime fighter because most of the people he goes after don't survive. It's death penalty all the way with the Punisher. So problem solved, which the Joker characters like that, they're constantly reoccurring. Batman doesn't solve any of the problems of Gotham City. Sometimes he only makes them worse, as you pointed out.
Do you think he actually exacerbates the crime rate? I mean, there's one story that I'll never forget. I can't remember who wrote it now, but Penguin like literally goes straight in a story. He falls in love. And like Batman just wrecks it for him. he just won't believe the Penguin's gone straight, and he just wrecks it, and the Penguin turns to crime again. It's like, holy shit.
I don't know, they would do anything for a story back then. They really would. I mean, I read a World's Finest story recently where Batman is suffering an inferiority complex, and Superman does all this fakery to like pull him out of it, make him feel better about himself.
I mean, while we're on the subject of Superman, I read somewhere that under Denny O'Neill, he didn't like the idea of Superman in Batman's world and tried to keep Gotham like as its own thing as much as possible while he was the editor. Was there any truth to that? Because
I can give you a specific example about that. A lot of times I was the logistics guy. I was the guy arguing for how could you make this happen, these fantastic events happen in a way that seems realistic, or at least has an interior reality to it. And one of the things that bothered me was following Cataclysm, Wayne Manor had to be rebuilt. And I said, well, there's no way in the world a construction crew could come in, rebuild Wayne Manor and not discover the Batcave. So I said that what if Wayne Manor was rebuilt at another site and then moved overnight by Superman and he puts it into place once it's completed? And I thought it was elegant. You could do it. You could just hint that it's Superman. You don't even have to show him. And Denny just loathed the idea. He wouldn't even, you know, he would not tolerate it. He said, no, we're never doing that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, it's, you know, but what you have is ridiculous, you know, if we don't do something like that. But he wouldn't, we just left it the way it was.
Well, I mean, what were your thoughts on like Batman and his world being a bit removed from the rest of the DC universe?
I mean, I was okay with it because, like, you know, everything has to have an interior reality. There were two Batmans. There was the Batman in Gotham, and there was the Batman who will climb into a spaceship and, you know, go with Green Lantern to another planet. And as a kid, I was able to just like sort of separate the two. These are just, he has a different role in these two different worlds. But yeah, I didn't want, I mean, obviously in something like No Man's Land or something like that, the Justice League could have arrived and solved the problem overnight. But it's, you know, that's
no. I mean, on the subject of the Justice League, Batman's kind of bossy with them too.
Yeah.
Why do they all put up with it? They could all, they could probably kill him, you know. But
well, you know, he's so often right. That's the really aggravating thing about Batman.
Zorro says, how would you distinguish a reactionary comic book superhero from a non-reactionary one, and I don't mean woke elements. Chuck?
I don't know. I guess you'd have to have a character that, you know, led with his emotions rather than reasoning. And I can't, you know, like an Oliver Queen character. Mm-hmm. He's obviously a liberal, but he's also sort of, he often finds himself on the wrong side of the fight.
I mean, just speaking as a fan, I've never been into the Marvel comics like X-Men, Spider. I just can't get on with them because they're all, it's just like, stop crying. Just stop, like, they've all got like issues all the time. And it's not like with Batman, he bottles it up and he just tells right. people to go away, which is the male thing to do, right?
Right.
With like Peter Parker, it's just like, stop moaning. I just can't, I mean, all of the X-Men are like that. And to me, that's why I always felt that like Marvel was kind of like identifiably liberal. And whereas the Batman world seems more reactionary to me anyway, but.
Yeah, even as a kid, I didn't like the X-Men. They were just a pack of whiners. Like, oh, I've got wings. You know, I was like, you know, oh, I'm at this exclusive school, you know. It's like they're all privileged. They got cool costumes and, you know, they got powers and, you know, but I didn't quite understand. Yeah, and you're right. A lot of the characters at Marvel sort of wear their emotions on their sleeve. Which, you know, in some cases is the appeal. I mean, as an adolescent, you know, I identified with Peter Parker because it just seems like the whole world's against me. Because you reach that age where you think the whole world's against you. And so I can relate to him.
There's a question in the chat here saying, please ask Mr. Dixon about adapting the work of Tolkien in a faithful manner, as I believe that you have done some of that.
Yeah, I did an adaptation of The Hobbit back in the, I guess, late 80s. That's still in publication. It's probably certainly my biggest selling project I've ever worked on. It's constantly in print all around the world. But it was tough because I didn't have a lot of room. It's not a particularly lengthy adaptation, so I had to cut things out. I kept all of Tolkien's language. There's none of my words in the book. It's all from Tolkien. I insisted on that going in. And then, but I had to cut things like Bjorn. Bjorn is my favorite character in the book, and I had to cut him.
Ben Wheeler says, Pinkerton's Ghost says hello. Proud to be on UATV with you, and hopefully Arkhaven 2 soon. Do you want to tell people about what is UATV and who is Pinkerton's Ghost?
UATV is another division of... of Vox World Inc. I don't know. another effort from the Dark Lord. It's a channel like YouTube, except it's uncancelable. It's a proponent of free speech, and I have a channel there where I go more in depth on subjects than I do on the YouTube channel. And I think there's like there's over 100 episodes available on. It's a subscription service.
Mm-hmm. I subscribe to I watch Vox's Dark Stream. I'll have to see if I can check out yours. I didn't even know you were on there until
It's called The Legend on Comics. Vox started calling me The Legend from the very first time I talked to him, and then it sort of caught on.
Well, I mean, appropriate. Zorro says Batman villain tier list stream when. Yeah, I mean, I guess the only question I've got on the where each of the villains stand in relation to the other is that in that Resurrection Night 400, it's very clear that the Ra's is the big bad. Whereas I feel like now it would be the Joker. Like, how do you, like, if you had to say, like, who are the very top tier villains, you know, cause, like in Batman 66, it was Penguin, Joker, Riddler, and Catwoman with a big right. four, but that it feels like that's changed over time. So I mean, Bane is a top tier threat as well, of course.
I always put Ra's at the top because, I mean, you know, by his very nature, he's a long game player. You know, he's definitely possibly Batman's intellectual superior, whereas the Joker isn't, and the Joker's flaw is he's nuts. The Joker is almost short-term memory loss. Scott Peterson, one of my editors on Batman, said that to get your head around the Joker, just imagine that he's a different person every day. When he wakes up, his psychosis is completely changed. His motives are completely altered, which is why he's difficult to catch and keep. But I wouldn't put him at the top. I don't like the Joker as a character. I like to write him, but I despise him as a character. And I'm supposed to. I mean, we're supposed to hate the Joker. There's nothing cool about that guy.
Just out of interest, where do you place the Penguin in things? Because, I mean, I don't know if it's because as a kid, I had a ZX Spectrum game where the two main ones were Joker and Penguin. But also in the Adam West series, I mean, Penguin was pretty major in that one as well. How do you see him in the overall scheme of things?
Well, I like how the 66 series, they did this a lot with the villains. They took them and fleshed them out. They gave them clear motives and distinctive personalities. And I like that the Penguin was a womanizer. He was vain. You know, you really didn't see a lot of that in the comics prior to that. But I like the Penguin, but he's a ridiculous character. He's in no way a physical threat to Batman. I don't care what kind of umbrellas he has. He's always going to, you know, go down with one punch. And that's why Graham and I came up with the idea of basically turning him into a Sidney Greenstreet type character, a background figure, a fixer, he's sort of this underworld guy that you go to, you know, if you needed to hire a henchman or if you needed a plan to rob a certain place. I mean, he's the guy you would go to. And then we came up with the Iceberg Lounge to complete the image.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the people who does pretty well out of No Man's Land. And,
he would. Particularly the way we situated him, where he's established. You know, he's actually in the same place every night, you know.
Matty G says, no questions, thanks for the stream. Dollface, thoughts on comparing Batman to the Shadow?
Well, Batman is a creature of many parts. You know, Dracula, Sherlock Holmes, the Shadow, the Phantom, the Scarlet Pimpernel. I mean, you know, all of these things combine to make Batman. It's a very derivative character. I think we wouldn't even remember him except that costume is awesome. And then it built from there. Dick Tracy, I should mention, too. There's a lot of borrowing from Dick Tracy at the beginnings of Batman's history.
I mean, do you like the golden age comics, back from the late 30s, early 40s era?
I in some cases I like the look of them. I'm a big fan of Dick Sprang. The stories, because DC's insistence that anyone over the age of 10 reading these comics has to be an idiot, kind of hurts things, because there's no editorial drive to write stories that are necessarily intelligent or even logical. And I think that even their view of children was dim. they were writing comics for particularly slow-witted children. So the comics look great, and they come up with these terrific premises, but so often they just don't pay off. Like I said, I've been reading a lot of like Silver Age World's Finest, and it's like grand ludicrousness. It's the stories are just insane, but they're silly at the heart of it.
Yeah, I like the Dick Sprang art as well. All right. Well, I don't have any further. I could ask you questions for the next 10 hours if you wanted, but unless anybody else had anything else, where can people find you, Chuck? And you've got a YouTube channel which I've been watching.
Yeah, I got a YouTube channel under my own name, Chuck Dixon. There's also chuckdixon.net. It's a website where I blog post movie reviews and a lot of unpublished comics. You can read some comics there that never saw print. And Arkhaven comics as well. Or just, you know, plug my name into Amazon. I'm all over the place there.
Yeah, and I would just say, if you're into this, if you enjoyed this interview, you've literally, I mean, it's over 100 episodes of Ask Chuck Dixon. I mean, I've been binging them over the weekend. goes into real depth about all sorts of things, including not just comics as well, like movies, westerns, all sorts of things. So I'd recommend you check that out. I will be back tomorrow night with Unpopular Opinions, just because I need to pay the bills here. I'll remind people that I'm currently doing my sale, Easter 25, for the academic agency. One last question before we go.
Yeah.
If people buy trade paperbacks or like the omnibus editions and things, do you still get a kickback from DC for books that are sold?
Only in the United States and Canada. We don't get international royalties anymore, and I've been bugging DC about it because it's literally in all of my contracts that we get international. I just did an interview with a guy in the Czech Republic this week talking about all of my great books being published in Czech for the first time. And I'm like, well, you know, they may be in Czech, but I ain't getting a Czech. So I've been trying to get other freelancers to stand up and question this, because it's like 2009, the checks just stopped coming. And DC keeps promising to look into it, but they never really come back with anything.
Is that a translation deal? Like, I'm assuming if we bought the comics in the UK, you would get it because it's in English, right? Is it because it's been translated?
No, if it's like when Titan Books was publishing a lot of DC stuff, and particularly Eagle Moss publishing a lot of stuff, no, we don't see anything. It's not a language thing. They sell the reprint rights by the page. So if you want to reprint 1,000 pages of Batman, you know, you're going to have to lay out about $50,000. To get them, and then we're supposed to get a piece of that, and it used to be a substantial check every 6 months, and they just simply stopped coming, and they didn't tell us they would stop coming. And I found out, you know, that the editor-in-chief at the time just decided that, hey, we're going to save money and stop sending these checks out. But unfortunately for guys like me from the 90s, hey, I got a contract that says you owe me this. So I wish more freelancers would step forward, but freelancers are craven. They're afraid, oh, I might not get any more work from DC. No. So you're going to let them keep tens of thousands of dollars in royalties? It doesn't make any sense.
Do you have any sense about how big that market is? Like, how many? I mean, I recently picked up one of these omnibus things, and you could knock someone out. Like, they're huge, these books. Do you have any sense of how big that market is? Like, are there thousands of people buying these books? Or
yeah, I mean, there is here in the United States, but the market's so much bigger in Europe because it's a bigger place, and comics aren't looked upon in Europe the way they are here. I mean, when I was on Detective Comics, I sold as many issues of Detective in Italy alone as I did in the United States, which is what really gripes me about the foreign royalties. I'm reaching many more readers.
You need to get those Italian the lira or euro these days in. Yeah. there's one last super chat before I let you go. He said, would you have rather met Prince, the singer, or Mustache Man, which is our little code name here for, you know, the famous leader of Germany from the mid-century?
I'd rather spend time with Prince.
Yeah, I thought you'd say that.
Hitler was probably a bore.
Yeah, well, I can imagine that classic.
Unless he was shouting at, like, you know, 100,000 people, he was boring. Because if you watch videos of him, you can see, okay, I can see this guy was compelling in front of a large audience. In person, he's probably a drag.
Yeah, I read something about Prince. Prince has got one of the biggest vocal ranges in history. He can hit, like, his highest note was higher than Christina Aguilera's. And he's just like one above Barry White on his lowest notes. So my one bit of Prince.
Also, an incredible guitarist.
All right,
and a loyal hometown guy. That's what I always admired about Prince. He didn't leave Minnesota. He got everybody he knew work and stayed in Minnesota and recorded in Minnesota. I was like, I respect the guy that stays in the hometown like that.
I mean. If we're going to talk about Prince, I did find out something strange about Prince. Well, yeah. in the early 80s, he had this band called the what were they called? They were like a kind of fake Prince outfit.
Yeah.
They did a song called like Ice Cream or something. What would they call that band? But I found out that he played all the instruments, he wrote all the songs, and literally the guys in that band were like miming. They'd go and play live shows. and they literally pretend to play the instruments. And he paid them like what you'd pay like an extra, like an actor. And they got cross at him and tried to like confront Prince and wanted like proper royalties and things. And he just replaced the entire band. I forget what they were called. Yeah, the time.
The time. Okay. Morris Day and the Time. Yeah.
I just find that really, really odd that he'd make this. It's actually almost like something a supervillain would do, like a kind of fake.
He had henchmen. Rather than a band, he had a gang.
Indeed. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Chuck. I'll probably go and have a cigar and listen to more. Ask Chuck Dixon. It's a nice sunny day here.
All right.
And hope to speak to you again one day.
Please have me back. I enjoyed this very much.
Great. See you soon.